Thank you, Brother McLeish. Appreciate the kind remarks, and it is again our privilege to be with you in this lectureship. We appreciate the great work that the Pearl Street Church does and the fine, firm stand for the truth that she has taken throughout the years. Appreciate all the good done through all of the numerous lectureships over the course of many years. We appreciate so much all of the work involved in that, and I know it's an enormous amount of energy that goes into this kind of work. I'm to talk about the issue over Matthew 19 and the whole book of Matthew, but it comes down to the issue of Matthew 19:9. But the question, of course, is whether or not Matthew is a part of the gospel. Why would anyone in our day, from our historical vantage point, began to question that or try to remove it from New Testament literature? It's because of the immorality of the time, because of the horrible mess the country is in the area of divorce and remarriage. We've been for many, many years now trying to find a way to skirt the force of plain obligation per Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9. If someone could find a way to get Matthew 19:9 and 5:32 out of the gospel, then that would remove what might be considered this onerous passage from the shoulders of all of us. And so that effort has been made. Other efforts have been made, none of which has yet been successful. I don't know how many more efforts will be made before people will tire of trying to say the New Testament does not say what it says about marriage, divorce, and remarriage doctrine. Back in January, we did have the opportunity of meeting Brother Billingsley, Dan Billingsley, in Arlington, Texas. This was a two-night discussion, two-night debate. Brother Billingsley has been one of the most cordial opponents I've ever had in discussion. He is that way. His doctrine is horrible. It's poisonous. It is a dreadful thing. He's a nice, amiable person to deal with on a personal level. But his doctrine needs to be exposed, and it doesn't take long to expose it. We had thought before we would have four-night discussion, but it turned out to be two, and that was really plenty of time to expose it. And I wish he did not advocate this doctrine. I wish all of his listeners or whoever believe it would give it up. I have no ill will toward him, but I think the doctrine is very, very wrong and very damaging to the cause of Christ. First chart, David, please. He affirmed, the Scriptures teach that Matthew 19:9 is not New Testament doctrine. The Scriptures teach that Matthew 19:9 is not New Testament doctrine. Next chart, please. On the second night, I affirmed the Scriptures teach that Matthew 19:9 is New Testament doctrine. Now, if Brother Billingsley can disprove my contention, and if he can prove his own, then, of course, that changes the way we begin to look at relationships and situations out here in the world. It changes our outlook toward the world's obligation to God through Christ. And, of course, he's already changed his outlook regarding them. He views them in a very different way. For years, before he came to this point where he was willing to deny this in public discussion, for years and years, of course, he's had a problem over amenability. Dub has debated him on that. I think Jerry Moffat did too, if I'm not mistaken. For years and years, he's been toying with some notion, some way of getting around Matthew 19:9, and this has just been the latest conclusion that he is unfortunately drawn in his trail of heresy. But if he could get rid of the book, then he gets rid of the passage. So we don't just zero in on the passage. He's got to get rid of the whole book of Matthew. Now, I want to do three things in this discussion. I want to point out some problems he had with questions that I asked him, various positions he took during the debate, and then how you go about proving that Matthew is a part of the New Testament. Next chart, David. We had an agreement that we would exchange the first night's questions several days before the debate actually took place. And I exchanged my questions with him, he with me. I gave him five true-false questions. You learn something about your opponent's position. You learn something about your opponent's honesty and integrity, and whether or not he is under a strain by the way that he's dealing with your questions. I always want an agreement beforehand in a debate to exchange questions. You can get so much further down the road in the discussion by doing that. And I want you to know we've got five. Now, this is chart A out of this. We've got two more on another chart. But notice these are all true-false. And every true-false, every precisely stated, now listen, every precisely stated proposition is either true or false. That means that if I've done my job in wording these correctly, if I've given enough precision to the statements, then the T or the F by each one should be able to be circled. All right, number one, the complete book of Acts is New Testament literature or doctrine. Is that true or false? Number two, Jesus said something while on earth, which was later quoted by an apostle, recorded by an inspired writer, which quotation and record show that the Lord's statement was intended to be a part of the New Testament. True or false? I was thinking particularly there about Acts 20, verse 35. Remember the words of the Lord Jesus. He himself said, it is more blessed to give than to receive. Number three, by the moral law, one is able to determine that it is sinful for a man to have more than one wife at the same time. Next chart, David. Number four, though Jesus, while on earth, gave the... Notice here, I'm putting these several expressions in quotation marks because I'm pulling these right out of Dan Billingsley's documents himself. I'm quoting from him when you see these quotation marks. Though Jesus, while on earth, gave the Great Commission for the New Covenant, and though he began some prophetical teaching for the New Testament age, and though he publicly taught the people of Israel some New Testament principles and Old Testament parables, prophecies, and hard sayings, he could not give New Testament marriage law. True or false? Number five, every legal marriage today is also a scriptural marriage, a marriage in which God has actually joined the two parties together per Matthew 19:6. Now, what would you do with those five questions? Now, remember, we had this was done before the debate ever took place. We had time to think about these and give our answers and send them back through the mail. Do you know that he answered every one of these questions by circling the T and the F? Every one of them. Now, brethren, that says something to me about him. I'm not trying to be unkind about that. And in the next night's questions, I exposed him further for the way he treated these. You don't deal with precisely stated propositions like that and be fair about it. He said these are all true and false. And then he had some writing. He said, well, it's true if you mean this, and it's false if you mean this, and it's true if you mean this, and it's false if you mean this. Can you read those and tell what we mean? Each one's precisely worded. Each one. And so he said true, false to all of them. True, false to every one of them. By the way, I was still living in Wellington, Texas when we were doing this. And on December the 30th, 1994, he dated a letter and sent it to my five elders and gave them some questions. He wanted them to answer some questions for me, for him. And he said, simple yes and no answers will be sufficient. Of all the gall. I'm telling you, that's very telling. He knows there's a way to do it. You can get it done. Now just say yes or no, and that'll be sufficient. Well, why wouldn't you say yes or no? He wouldn't. He couldn't bring himself to do it. And question three, when he says, well, it's, you know, he'll say true if you mean this, false if you mean this, true if you mean this. Question three, the only conditions he listed were conditions that rendered it true. And he still could not bring himself to answer it true. That's really pitiful. It's a dishonorable way of measuring up your responsibility. It's a failure to do so. That's the way the debate started. A failure to measure up to responsibility. Well, so the next night, David, next chart. We had these questions for him. Every precisely stated proposition is either true or false. He said true. Well, then why did you do me the way you did the first night? Number two. Acts chapter 1, the literature is New Testament teaching, a part of the New Testament. And he says true. And that gives him no trouble when he said that. And he said it is. You see, he knows you can't stand for him to say you've got a part of the book of Acts that's not New Testament literature. He knows that won't wash. But we've got part of Acts chapter 1 that deals with time that is like the time you're dealing with in the last part of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. But he knows he can't bring himself to disjoin chapter 1 and chapter 2. So he says true. Number 3. Jesus, while living under the law of Moses, personally lived above the requirement of the law. He says true. Well, of course, that is true, but Billingsley didn't understand the question. Because later on in the discussion, when he answered it and when he talked about it, he says Jesus, you know, kept the law perfectly. Well, Jesus did keep the law perfectly, but that's not living above the law. Now think about that, brethren. That's not living above the requirement of the law. That's living according to the requirement of the law. And so we had somewhat to say about that later on. Though he answered the question right, he did not understand the full import of it. Then number four, next chart, D. Brown. Mark 6:17 teaches that Herod married a woman to whom he had no scriptural right to be married. He admits that's true. That is true. And then number five, during the periods of patriarch and Judaism, if a man had more than one wife at the same time, he was in violation of moral law. He said that's true. He answered that one wrong. That's false. All the others were true. This one's false. He answered this true too. Brother Billingsley, and I knew this from other discussions. I knew it from the writings that he had presented. He does not know what to do about moral law. He doesn't understand moral law. To this good hour, he thinks we're all still under what he calls the moral law for marriage from Genesis chapter 2. But I know he does not even understand the moral law. And it was not a violation of moral law for a man to have more than one wife in patriarchy or Judaism. It was not. It's a violation now of New Testament law, positive law. But you have to have the definition of new terms and the propositional wording to get us to give us the positive law of Jesus Christ regarding what our marriage and divorce obligations are. But that's not a violation of moral law. If that's a violation of moral law, then every Jew who had more than one wife ought to have gone to hell. Right? Unless you can go to heaven while living in your while dying in your immorality. Jacob had two wives and two concubines. You remember that? And yet the Lord said in Matthew 8 that those outside would come from the east and the west and sit down in the kingdom of heaven with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You take the position that's a violation of moral law, you've got immoral people gracing heaven. That's one of his problems. He does not know what to do about moral law and its connection with positive law or pure positive law. Okay. Now, that's just dealing with the two sets of questions. Let me go right now into some positions that he took during the course of the discussion. He pointed out that all men today are under God's universal moral law for marriage from Genesis chapter 2. Of course, you and I realize that Moses was writing Genesis chapter 2. And Genesis chapter 2 is a part of the corporate book, the whole book of the law. And it was nailed to the cross. But Brother Billingsley has another way of looking at that now. He also says that the world today is not under the New Testament legislation regarding divorce. That members of the church are under divorce legislation in the New Testament. And then he says that the new covenant begins to be revealed in Acts 2. Though he admits that Acts chapter 1 is New Testament doctrine, the gospel begins to be, or new covenant begins to be revealed in Acts chapter 2. And he says that Jesus just basically taught what the Jewish fathers taught. You see, when Dan Billingsley reads Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, what he sees is Jesus Christ reiterating or clarifying or emphasizing, calling attention to what the law had basically all the time taught. That's what he thinks the Lord did. That's the position that he has taken. And of course, he would say Jesus Christ was not a Christian, as though anybody thought that he was one. He claimed that Jesus taught the law of Moses, revealed the Old Testament parables and so on. He claimed that Moses had given only one reason for divorce. This is as false as it can be. But Billingsley, during the course of our discussion, when you come to Matthew 19:9, he would say, the Lord is just telling us what Moses taught. That is false. And I'm going to show that in just a few moments. But that's part of the problem here. Well, the Lord is just clarifying what Deuteronomy 24:1 said all the time throughout the history of Judaism. But I will try to show, of course, that that is not so. He says, now what you're going to have to do is to find where Jesus said something new. Find the passage in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John where Jesus taught something new. Now, he'll admit, you know, he can teach some Old Testament parables with some application or something or other, prophecies, but basically there's no didactic teaching. There's no concrete information that's of new covenant value that's being talked about by Christ during his personal ministry before the cross. And that's the way Brother Billingsley is looking at this. And so he says, you've got to find a passage where Jesus teaches something new. And so we tried to do that for the debate, and we did that as well. Furthermore, Billingsley claimed that if Jesus taught New Testament doctrine, New Covenant doctrine, while during his personal ministry, that was wrong. That he would be violating the law of Moses. Can you imagine that? If the law itself anticipated its own demise, if by prophecies like Isaiah 2, 2, 3, 4, other passages, Jeremiah 31, 31 and following, if the law was anticipating an incorporated material to let you know the law is going to stop and that you're to go to Jesus, there's another law coming. The word of the Lord will go forth from Jerusalem. What Billingsley is claiming is false. But he says, if Jesus taught another law while living under the old law, that would have been wrong. It would not have been wrong if Jesus were teaching that in such fashion as to let it be known this is to be applied in the new scheme of things. We also know from Matthew 5 that Jesus taught obedience to the law, don't we? Why, he taught that very plainly. You have no right to disobey any of the law of Moses. So while he obeyed the law and taught others to obey the law, he was also teaching material above the law, as I'll show, and getting ready for the time when this above the law material would become applicable in human affairs. All right. And then he said that his opponent simply could not answer his arguments. My experience with Brother Billingsley was he never offered an argument. He just talks. He just asserts. Sometimes in a disconnected fashion, perhaps, and maybe in his own mind he's got an argument, but he needs to formulate it. He needs to write it out in a logical form for proper, so it can be properly addressed. But he needs to give arguments. And so that's the way that he went about it. Then he asserted that Jesus violated the law of Moses if he taught New Testament doctrine. Yes, I just said that. And he said that if we today try to bind Matthew 19:9 on anyone, we are falling from grace. That's what he said. That's the position that he took. And also, and get a hold of your hat in his third affirmative, he said, now remember, we're getting down to the point, we're gradually getting into it, is Matthew part of the New Testament? He said in his third affirmative, it does not matter when something is written. Now we'll find out maybe later why he wants to take a position like that. It doesn't matter when something is written. That is as awful and as false as it can be. But now he wants to say, New Testament doctrine starts in Acts 2, goes through Revelation 22. All right, but you've already said that Acts 1 is New Testament doctrine. He does not know what to do, really, about Acts chapter 1. All right, now, how do we go about proving that Matthew is a part of the New Testament? I gave three arguments in the debate. Chart B3, David, if you will. How do you go about doing that? Maybe we can get some of this on here. You may have to strain to see it, and David may have to move the chart. If the Lord's teaching, this is the major premise. Argument 1, if the Lord's teaching in Matthew 19:9 is not a restatement of Mosaic marriage law, and if it is not legislation applicable only to the era initiated by John and which ended with the establishment of the church, the transition era, then it is a part of his last will and testament. Number 2, the Lord's teaching in Matthew 19:9 is not a restatement of Mosaic marriage law, and it is not legislation applicable only to the era initiated by John and which ended with the establishment of the church. I know that by Luke 16:16, Matthew 11:11, and Acts chapter 2. Then it is a part of his last will and testament. Now, there are only three possibilities for application of Matthew 19:9. The marriage divorce law. It either was for the Jews under Judaism, as long as that scheme went on, or it started with the new regime, Luke 16:16, the law and the prophets were until John, though technically they don't end on the cross, Colossians 2:14, a new era with new divine law being imposed on Jews. It starts there and it goes up to Acts 2. When the gospel is preached for the first time, the church is started. It either has application during that transition period, or, thirdly, it has application during the days after the church has been established. Acts 2 on. Now, where does it fit? Billingsley says it fits in the first category. It goes with Old Testament doctrine and the book of Matthew and Mark and Luke and John tack on to Malachi. Goes with the Old Testament canon. All right, we'll try to show in just a little while why that will not work. Now, next chart, please, David, 22a. Look at Matthew 19:9 in comparison to Deuteronomy 24:1. Billingsley says that Christ in Matthew 19:9 is simply reaffirming what Moses wrote in Deuteronomy. So the application of Matthew 19:9 is in Judaism, the Old Testament period. This would mean that Jesus taught, whoever married a woman put away unlawfully for reasons other than fornication would be committing adultery. And whoever married a woman put away lawfully for fornication would not be committing adultery. Now 22b, David. Now think about this very, very carefully, brethren, these next two charts. But according to the law of Moses, if a husband suspected fornication on the part of his wife, he could have the matter tested. You understand that's a part of the law of Moses? You don't have to go around wondering whether or not your wife's been unfaithful to you or not. In the days of miracles, he could have the matter resolved by a test. Numbers chapter 5, called the law of jealousy. Now, if she is innocent, he cannot divorce her, according to Billingsley's doctrine. If she is guilty, she could be divorced and is free to remarry, per Billingsley's doctrine. But Moses taught that if she were found guilty, she would be cursed among the people. Numbers 5, verse 27. Furthermore, that chapter points out that if she is guilty, her belly would swell and her thigh would rot. Now, do you think you want to come along and marry her? Now, you think about that. He's saying in Matthew 19:9, Jesus is giving you Old Testament marriage law. He's just clarifying what it's about back there. No, he's not just clarifying what it's all about back there. Back in that law, you could have a suspected infidelic wife tested. Number two, chart 22C, David, let's go to the next chart. If there were witnesses to a married woman's fornication, she was to be put to death. She wasn't to be divorced and then somebody else come along and remarry her, be guilty of adultery with her or whatever. She was to be put to death. Those passages are on that point. Number three, if a husband falsely charged his wife with premarital fornication, he could never divorce her. Does that sound like Matthew 19:9? Jesus just saying what the law said? Hardly. Deuteronomy 22:19. Number four, the uncleanness of Deuteronomy 24:1 cannot be past sexual uncleanness, fornication, in the case of a girl who becomes a wife for the first time, because that girl is to be killed. Say you marry somebody and all of a sudden you find out she's not a virgin. What about her? Well, we find out she's not. She's not to be divorced. They say you did marry her, but she's not to be divorced. She is to be put to death. Is that Matthew 19:9? This means that in Matthew 19:9, Jesus is not teaching what Deuteronomy 24:1 taught. Now, we had a chart on Deuteronomy 24:1. I did not bring that with me, and I do not really need that right now. But Deuteronomy 24:1 refers, of course, to an uncleanness. A man marries a woman and finds something unclean. But the law did not say that it had to be adultery, it had to be fornication, some unseemly thing. It really said that, an unseemly thing. The law was structured in such a fashion as to give divorce possibilities or possibility for various reasons. I tell you, the Lord could have been as precise in Deuteronomy 24:1 as He was in Matthew 19:9 if He wanted to be. Had God wanted to structure the language, He could have given it in such precision that there would not have been any two-school development over the doctrine. There would not have been any controversy over it. But there arose controversy because of the way the verse reads. It allows possibilities. Unseemly thing. All right, and so you have those four points on the chart that point out that it's not really a matter of restatement of Moses' law. All right, why couldn't God have simply given clear information on that? Well, He could have. Hillel and Shammai disagreed on it later, as you know. But we realize in Matthew 23, Jesus did, however, say some of the Jews were teaching correctly on it. That's why I could tell the Jews, now whatever they tell you, the teachers of the law who sit in Moses' seat, what they teach you, you do that. Just don't follow their actions because they'll tell you the truth and not do it themselves. The Pharisees, Matthew 23, he said somebody in the Jewish camp was teaching the truth on marriage, divorce, remarriage law, per the law of Moses. So you can't just say it was just up for grabs. There were various allowances allowed in Deuteronomy chapter 24. Now let's check on that again. Let's go to chart 23A, David. Next chart. Is Jesus clarifying Deuteronomy 24:1? If he is, then notice what follows. He is doing what no other prophet of God ever did when he taught on marriage. You go back and you discuss or you analyze the passages where there were problem situations regarding marital relationships or whatever. No prophet ever said what Jesus said in Matthew 19:9 about Old Testament law. Nobody ever said that. Number two, if he's clarifying, he is clarifying what would not possibly be understood without a clarification. There was no way to know that what Jesus is saying would be true without his saying it. The way the verse is rendered, the way it's written in the Old Testament. There's no way to know that there's just one reason for divorce back there. There's no way to get that. You could guess about that and surmise and think and wonder about it. You could not prove it or establish it. Number three, his so-called clarification really amounts to a conflict with other verses in the marriage law body of material. And number four, his clarification is made just before the law is terminated. That's also a striking point to me. If Jesus in Matthew 5:32 and 19:9 is simply telling, this is what the law of Moses really taught all the while about marriage divorce, why does God want it clarified just before he nails it to the cross? Why wouldn't he clarify it back in the initial stages of its applicability? But he didn't do that, did he? He let thousands of years go by. Then somebody comes along just before he nails it to the cross, and here's what it meant all the while. Well, if I were a Jew and my soul were at stake, I believe I would have liked to have had clarification a little bit earlier. Wouldn't you? I believe we would. And let me add to number five that I don't have on this chart. You think about this, brethren. This is number five. Just imagine it down here. You got a good imagination? Imagine it. Jesus in Matthew 19 said that God, because of the hardness of men's hearts, suffered them to put away their wives. He suffered them to put away their wives. You see, if Jesus is clarifying in Matthew 19:9 what Deuteronomy 24:1 says, and yet, according to the Pharisees in Matthew 19, men had been able to divorce for various reasons, and Jesus says, well, God allowed you to put away your wives for the hardness of your hearts. He was not allowing them to put away their wives for fornication because of the hardness of their hearts. You ever thought about that point? That's a crushing point. Wish I'd thought about it before the debate. He did not suffer them to put away their wives for fornication because of the hardness of their hearts, but he was suffering them to put away their wives for the hardness of hearts, which means he was allowing them to divorce and remarry without the stricture of Matthew 19:9 being applicable. He was allowing divorce, though he hated it, Malachi 2. But he was allowing it. He was scripturally, by the law of Moses, authorizing divorce for various reasons. Now, you think about if Deuteronomy 24:1 and Matthew 19:9 are equivalents, what the Lord says in Matthew 19 about the father's sufferance means God told you you could not put away your wives except for fornication, but for the hardness of your hearts, he lets you put away your wives for reasons other than fornication. So that the law says you can't put her away, and then you put her away, and God says, that's okay, I'm going to allow it anyway. Which gets God in contradiction with his own marriage law. That's such a crushing point. I hope that's clear to you. That point by itself, without the other four, shows that Matthew 19:9 is not restating or clarifying Deuteronomy 24, verse 1. Now, what we do understand, of course, from Deuteronomy 24 to Matthew 19:9 is that during the course of patriarchy and Judaism, God just did not impose ideal marriage law on the world, on anybody. But now through Christ, he has done that. If God was saying you cannot put women away except for fornication, but he allowed men to do it, he's either saying you can and you cannot, or you cannot, but it doesn't matter if you do. We know God is not mocked. He would not allow the Jews to make a mockery of his marriage law, and he did not. But he did not impose on them through Jewish legislation the ideal construction. But in the new covenant, he imposes by positive law the ideal marriage arrangement. One man, one woman in marriage till death. Now let's come to B4. David, this is a passage that Brother Billingsley really doesn't know what to do with. The law and the prophets were until John. From that time, the gospel of the kingdom of God is preached, and every man entereth violently into it. Now, you and all, we understand the technical demise of the law took place at the cross, Romans 7, 1 through 6, Colossians 2, 14. But now, not considering the technical relationship of the old law to the new, we do understand that during this period, the transition era, which commences with John, God begins to impose new regulations on Jews, which had not heretofore been a part of the law of Moses. The law and the prophets were until John. From that time, we start with some new obligations. And Jesus lives during this time. Jesus does teaching during this period. So Jesus is doing his work after this new era starts. You see, remember, Brother Billings is saying, no, all Jesus did, he was teaching the law. But now this passage says the law and the prophets were until John. So something else, the gospel of the kingdom begins to be preached. John did it himself. Then Jesus follows on the work of John, does it himself. It is blind and wrong to say Jesus just comes along and just gives Old Testament information. That is not true. Brother Billingsley does not know what to do about the transition era in Luke 16. Now, B14, David. Notice Jesus and John here. If Jesus taught nothing other than the law of Moses, then why did he make disciples? Remember, John came with new obligations. He told people to believe on Christ. They had not been told on that before. The Christ that was immediately to come. To repent of sins. To confess their sins. To be baptized for the remission of their sins. If Jesus did nothing in his teaching but to teach the law of Moses, then he did less than John, who was preparing for him. Now, next chart, David. On the second night, I offer two negative arguments, the first of which is as follows. If Jesus authorized the doing of one thing that was not authorized by the law of Moses as binding on all the Jews, then it is false to say that all Jesus taught was the law of Moses. Minor premise, Jesus authorized the doing of one thing, that's all it takes, that was not authorized by the law of Moses as binding on all the Jews. Number three, then it is false to say that all Jesus taught was the law of Moses. Now, chart 52, the next chart. We all understand Jesus lived under the law. No question about that, Galatians 4:4. No doubt about that. He was born under the law. But the question is, while he is under the law, can he say anything that has application after that law is done? Brother Billingsley says he can't. We say he did. Now notice, Jesus obeyed the law. 2 Corinthians 5:21, sinlessly so. He taught other Jews to obey the law. Matthew 23:3, for example. He called on Jews to accept him as the Messiah of Old Testament prophecy. All of those passages are on that point. Matthew 23:10 following. Next chart, David. And furthermore, he declared rights that would become available later. I want to come back to this Mark 7:19 in just a minute or so. But he talked about rights that would become available later. John 4:21, where would worship be carried on? The Jews had to do some of their worship in Jerusalem. Requirement of the law. John 4:21 anticipates a time when neither in this mountain nor in Jerusalem will be the worshiping spot. He gave obligations that would go into effect later. What about the Lord's Supper? And of course, a dispute in this discussion was Matthew 19:9. Were all the Jews under obligation in Matthew 26 to observe the Lord's Supper under Judaism? Hardly. Next chart, David. 52c, Jesus lived beyond the requirement of the law and taught beyond the requirement of the law because he changed definition of key terms, though he quoted the Old Testament scriptures. Now, this is something Brother Billingsley had not understood. Matthew 5:48, the definition of enemy. Matthew 22:37 through 40, the definition of neighbor. With other passages, it is clear. Jesus sometimes would quote Old Testament passages, and yet in his own mind, as shown from other discussions that he had, he was changing a definition of a word. All right. And then let's see the next chart, David, if we could. 52D. He predicted the time when Gentiles and Jews would be united together unto God by the gospel, and he predicted that the gospel would be preached throughout the whole world before the fall of Jerusalem. Now, chart 35b, let's come back to this changing definition matter to make this more clear if we can. Under the law of Moses, a neighbor was a fellow Jew. If you doubt that, you look at Leviticus 19:18. When they loved their neighbors, they loved Jews. That's what the Bible, the Old Testament law taught them to do. They were to love the Jew. Jesus redefined neighbor in the story of the Samaritan to be Jew or non-Jew, did he not? In Matthew 22, Jesus is pointing out the two greatest commandments in the law. Love God, all your heart, soul, mind, strength. Love your neighbor as yourself. He said the law hangs on these two. But since he redefined neighbor, it is clear that Jesus intended that those respecting his new covenant would love all men. Now that's a part of the book of Matthew, is it not? Yes, it is. Furthermore, in Romans chapter 13, verse 10, Paul says we are to love our neighbor. We're to fulfill the law. What neighbor do you mean, Paul? Love fellow Jews? No, love all men. Since Paul could quote the law of Moses in Romans 13, 10 and say we are to love neighbor, and neighbor's not just Jew, we get the impression, you see, that the definition has changed. Luke 10 changed the definition, but Romans 13, 10 is New Testament doctrine. If Romans 13, 10 is New Testament doctrine, when Paul says love neighbor, Jesus says love neighbor and defines it in Luke 10 as anybody, why is it that New Testament doctrine? Because the law did not teach such a wide scope obligation with regard to your fellow man. The law did not. These are very, very important points on key terms being changed, definitions being changed by Christ. He taught something new. Remember Billingsley said, you've got to find where Jesus taught something new. We found it. It's there. Next chart, David. Let's see. Did Jesus ever, while on earth, command anything not demanded by the law? Yes, the apostles were to be a part of the inaugural Lord's Supper. The apostles were placed under obligation to preach to the Jews. Matthew chapter 10. Next chart, B2. Negative argument 2. If Jesus said something which, if intended to be a part of the law of Moses, would actually constitute a conflict with that law, but which, if intended to be a part of another law, would constitute no conflict with that law, then Jesus said something that was not a part of the law of Moses. B2, if you can find it there, David. Jesus said something which, if intended to be a part of the law of Moses, would actually constitute a conflict with that law, but which, if intended to be a part of another law, would constitute no conflict with that law. Therefore, Jesus said something which was not a part of the law of Moses. See, the point is, what if Jesus tells the Jews to do something, but if they do it, they violate the law? Well, that won't work. But what if he tells them to do something, he has in mind doing it at a time in which it will not be violation, then you've got a different situation. Now this passage, Mark 7:19, next chart, David, is quite telling on this point. B20. We know that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are not a part of the Mosaic law because of the scope of obligation imposed by them, all men. Some things authorized by them could not be practiced by the Jews under the law. Mark 7:19. Jews couldn't eat certain meats, could they? Jesus made a statement in Mark 7:19, making all meats clean, but not yet. If they'd gone out and eaten meats that he just made clean, they would have violated the law. That by itself points out the fact he's anticipating a time when all men will have access to all meats, but it's not yet. He said things during his preaching and teaching intended to find application when his new law went into effect. He made all meats clean. Technically, they didn't become clean till he died. All right, that's so important. Thirdly, we know Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are part of the New Testament canon because these books were written by the authority of Christ. Genesis through Malachi weren't. They were inspired books, divine books, written by the authority of God, But these books were written by the authority of Christ. You recall John 14 and John 16. Jesus says the Holy Spirit will come upon you, the apostles. He's going to call to mind the things that I've said, guide you into all the truth, declaring to you the things that are to come. These books were written after Pentecost of Acts 2 by the authority of Christ, being moved by the Holy Spirit, these men wrote. That puts them in a classification of literature all by themselves with the rest of the New Testament canon. All right, I'm about to quit. 25. The next time is my time too, so I'm about to quit here. Brother Billingsley knew you can get books on introduction. Some of the dates will vary a little bit. But somewhere around 50 A.D., Matthew was written. Mark was written 65 to 68. Luke, somewhere prior to 61, but Luke was writing it as a member of the church. John, 85 to 95. These books were written after Pentecost, after the church is established. Now, that's an interesting thing. Because, you see, Billingsley said, it doesn't matter when a book is written. Now, you think about that. If Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are Old Testament documents, that's what he claims. They belong with the Old Testament. You've got God sending out four Old Testament pieces of literature, the law of Moses coming out in clarification or whatever, appendix form, whatever it is. Four books coming out, and they are dead at the time they come out, as far as application. That's what it means, brethren. Because the law died when Jesus died, Colossians 2:14. You go through 15 to 20 years before the first book is written in the church. And all these books, after the law of Moses has been nailed to the cross, then God has the apostles or prophets write these books, and when they come from the pen, they are dead as far as application. I don't understand that. Billingsley doesn't either. That's why he can say it doesn't matter when it's written. Doesn't matter when it's written. Oh, yes, it matters a lot. Why would God send out law that's binding on no one? Clarification not binding on anyone. That makes no sense at all. And that's where it is. We've got a few more charts I didn't get to showing the relationship of the covenants and the books and so on, but we don't have time for that. Thank you much for your kind attention.